That's the legend himself, Robert Nesta Marley, Bob Marley, with so much trouble in the world. And it's a good clue as to where we're going today. We'll be talking about some hot spots all over the world. And, of course, we have a very trusted guide. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday, May the 19th, 2015. And as I said, a briefing on a few hot-button issues related to major developments around the world, and especially looking at the role of the United States in them. Our guide is diplomatic scholar, historian, attorney, and prolific author, Dr. Gerald Horn, and he'll be discussing these issues with us. As you know, Gerald Horn is no stranger to Lead Stories. He is the person, he is the go-to person in really taking all these things apart in there and presenting the component parts to us in a way that very few people I know can do. Gerald Horn is the John Jay and Rebecca Moores Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He also teaches graduate courses in diplomatic history and has written more than 30 books and more than 100 scholarly papers and reviews on struggles against imperialism, colonialism, fascism, and racism. And I suspect strongly, Gerald, that there is another book in the making.
Oh, you're absolutely correct, and thank you for inviting me. Before I go a step further, I should mention happy Malcolm X birthday, happy Ho Chi Minh birthday, and happy Augusto Sandino birthday.
Thank you.
The book that will be out in the fall is on the Haitian Revolution and the origins of the Dominican Republic, and the role of the United States in both. And then in January, a short biography of Paul Robeson.
Well, of course, Gerald Horn was with us when the books came out. Of course, we discussed them here at great length on Lead Stories, Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow, and my really great, great favorite of mine now, and it is something I highly recommend, especially to budding historians, and to get an entirely different take on the great Independence Day. The book is titled The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance, and the Origins of the United States of America. It's a phenomenal work, and I urge you to put your hands on a copy. Well, Gerald, as we talk, the story of the moment, especially on the international scene, from the news coverage that we're receiving, all eyes are in Iraq, especially the city of Ramadi, which fell to ISIS just over the weekend. 70 miles from Baghdad. And already, of course, this has given new fuel to the fire that people want to throw President Obama into, saying that it, of course, is the result of his failed strategy in Iraq, and therefore the response to be a revved-up military intervention in Iraq. How are you reading the coverage here, and how are you reading the way it's being presented as we understand it? What should we actually look at this development to mean?
Well, obviously you raise a very important point that I'll get to momentarily, but I feel compelled to raise a domestic point before we get into these international struggles. And that is the situation in Waco, Texas, with the biker gangs involved in a shootout involving the police authorities. I think we need to pay very careful and close attention to these biker gangs, because many of them have overlapping memberships with white supremacist organizations and indeed law enforcement organizations. They recruit heavily amongst military veterans. Many of them are involved in criminality. In fact, there have been credible allegations that some of them cooperate with the police, with which they have overlapping members, in terms of shaking down black so-called gangs for their weapons and then selling them on the black market and getting even larger weapons. We know that during the 1960s, many of these so-called biker gangs cooperated with the authorities in terms of suppressing black militancy. So it's a very ominous development, particularly for those of us who've studied the origins of European fascism. And when you look at, I don't want to be too alarmist, but certainly when you look at what's going on in Texas and with the governor of Texas calling out the state authorities to monitor the U.S. military, believe it or not, which he feels is involved in a conspiracy with the commander-in-chief, Barack Obama, to take over certain parts of Texas, arrest political opponents of the president, confiscate their guns. Apparently, according to this conspiracy, Walmart, believe it or not, is involved. And I think that that's an appropriate preface by which we can now approach what's going on in Iraq, which, as you noted, some of the Republican candidates for president, not least being Lindsey Graham, the senior senator from South Carolina who plans to run for president, claims that the debacle in Iraq that's presently unfolding with the Islamic State gaining territory there and in neighboring Syria is a direct result of President Obama pulling out troops, Senator Graham would say prematurely in approximately 2011, that the debacle is not due to the original sin, that is to say, the invasion of Iraq in 2003 by one President George W. Bush, which, as another presidential candidate, Senator Rand Paul said, helped to destabilize what he called a secular leader, meaning Saddam Hussein, and helped to inaugurate the ascendancy of religious zealotry. And, of course, President Obama himself is not an innocent in this regard, because he did the same thing in Libya by destabilizing the Gaddafi regime, presiding over his murder in a certain sense, which has now led the Islamic State to establish a firm foothold in Libya, which has helped to open Libya to a certain kind of migration from Africa across the Mediterranean to Europe, which is causing a major crisis in the European Union. In fact, some of the recent news stories have suggested that some European nations might be sending submarines even to sabotage these boats crossing the Mediterranean or even bombing Libya. Now, President Obama, when he was Senator Obama, famously talked about he was not against all wars, he was against dumb wars. Well, certainly this catastrophe in Libya could be classified and categorized easily as a dumb war and has an eerie resemblance to the catastrophe now unfolding in Iraq. And President Obama is even more culpable in a sense, because recall that it was not so long ago that he referred to the so-called Islamic State as the junior varsity, quote-unquote, and apparently was not taking them seriously. Historians will have to sort out whether or not President Obama was misled by his national security team, and that's one of the points that I think historians are going to puzzle over, which is to what extent did President Obama have total control over his national security team, particularly when we recognize that a significant percentage of the all-important Euro-American community not only leans to the right, but many of them do not feel he was born in the United States. Many of them think he's either a secret Muslim or a secret communist and have no confidence in his leadership, which is one of the reasons you have so many Republicans seeking to replace him, basically comprising a clown car team of Republican candidates.
What did you say? A clown car.
Actually, that's not original. Clown car is sort of the term that's now being tossed about to describe these Republican oafs who are competing for president. Dana Milbank of the Washington Post used it most recently. But this is an important point, because I think that one of the defects of the analysis, if I can use that term, often employed by many of our friends on the left, is that everything is reduced to personalities. I mean, for example, Obama is treated like he's a lover who spurned us. You know, we gave you our trust and you deceived us, you know, rather than looking at the forces at play, the class forces, the race forces, the international forces that help to govern and shape how an administration can act and will act. Few of our friends on the left, despite their disappointment with Obama, have drawn any inferences from the fact that right now the odds-on candidate to replace him is Hillary Rodham Clinton, who is to his right, arguably. And one would think that if our friends on the left had an accurate analysis, then Obama would be replaced by someone to his left, maybe like Bernie Sanders, for example. But even Senator Sanders of Vermont, the Democratic Socialist, does not feel he has a ghost of a chance of defeating Hillary Rodham Clinton. So once again, I think at the end of the day, we have to sharpen our analysis, even develop an analysis, if we are to rescue ourselves from the dire fate that is being planned for us.
Well, they say in every crisis, there's also a moment of opportunity. And here, I'm drawing now on your history, your penchant for history. When this situation is, I mean, as it is unfolding, does it not give an opportunity, does it not present an opportunity for some sane voices, and I know this is probably a stupid thing to suggest that there are sane voices in these circles, to say, look, in effect, Obama himself has been caught in the web of politics in its truest sense, and that is, what did he have to do to survive? Did he make the right decision, or did he make the expedient decision? The right decision would have been to present the choices that he had to make in appropriate context. That, you know, here he was, he's inheriting a really bad situation. Which was the right way to go? Now, is it that because if you have such a discussion, it is embarrassing, or it seems simplistic, or it seems to it demystifies the awesome power of the office to openly discuss which was the right way to go? Or is it that Obama decided, look, I've got to make a decision here. I can't sacrifice my presidency by disappointing too many people. I have to walk the middle of the road, and heaven knows which forces were winning at the time coming at him. So have we lost that opportunity? Is that opportunity completely lost for people to understand the actual context of this struggle and why the United States actually is to be blamed for starting this level of warfare and creating ISIS?
Well, first of all, you suggested that I try to place this in a historical context, and let me do so. I think, as you so graciously mentioned with regard to the book I published last year, Counter-Revolution 1776, one of the theses I put forward in the book is that if you look at the origin of the United States, it was born in a revolt in part against the religious conflicts in Europe, Protestant versus Catholic, which is still suffusing Great Britain, the original mother country, and Christians versus Jewish and Christians versus Muslim, which, of course, the latter going back hundreds of years, in fact, to the Crusades. And then, of course, if you look at the other major colonizing power, Spain, the Spanish Inquisition unfolding in the late 15th century. But most historians stop there, and they celebrate the First Amendment and the formal declaration of freedom of religion, but they don't go to the next point, which is that religious axis was replaced by a racial axis, that is to say, those defined as white versus those defined as not white. And those of us in the latter category obviously have had, shall we say euphemistically, a tough time in North America since the founding of the United States of America. But what happened in the 20th century was the rise of the class project, that is to say, the organization of industrial unions, which reclassified many of us as being working class and working class militants, and of course the rise of socialist countries, which tried to develop a class axis, and then began pointing the finger of accusation at the United States with regard to its racial axis, which forced the United States to retreat from the racial axis, But then the socialist project and the class project began to crumble a few decades ago, and thus you had the resurgence and recrudescence of religion and race, which is what you see with regard to religion, of course, and the rise of the Islamic State, Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, and all of the rest. And, of course, the race in terms of Baltimore, Ferguson, Staten Island, et cetera. And we know that the racial project is now moving ahead at full speed. We see that in Staten Island, the prosecutor who failed to gain an indictment of those who murdered Eric Garner on tape, instead of being demoted, he was promoted. He's now on his way to Congress. We see that in the state of Missouri, in terms of the killing of Michael Brown, that the state legislature did not change the law, although they were under pressure to do so with regard to use of deadly force by police officers. And we see that in general, many pundits and commentators are telling us that many in the Euro-American community, instead of being sympathetic to those of us subjected to police violence, feel that we're getting too much attention. This points to a couple of points. One, the underestimation of many on the left of the depths of white supremacy, not only in the ruling elite, but in the middle class and working class. And once you make that underestimation, it's difficult to make an analysis that is relevant to President Obama, which brings me to the point that President Obama's option, once he came into power, was to try to rely heavily upon a black community, which for whatever reason has been generally supportive of him. But given the history of the United States, to have a self-proclaimed black president rely upon a black base in order to push forward progressive programs could have caused many problems. We all saw what happened in the summer of 2009, which it seems to me was the beginning of the eclipse of the Obama administration, when in an impromptu session at a news conference, he expressed sympathy for Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates Jr. He said President Obama said that it was stupid, quote unquote, for police to arrest him outside of his Cambridge house. And that, of course, unleashed a tirade by the police authorities, helped to alarm many in the Euro-American working class and middle class, feeling that the president was not on their side. They feel that a president should always stand against a black person, given the history of the United States. It's understandable why they feel that way. And once that trend was set, then President Obama would have a hard time. And then he seems to me he made his biggest mistake, which in many ways he's acknowledged, when he invaded Libya and presided over the killing of Gaddafi. And I say that because Secretary of the Pentagon Bob Gates was opposed to this intervention. It was hawkish Secretary of State Clinton and Samantha Power and Susan Rice who were pushing for that escapade, that ill-advised adventure. And that helped to anger and alienate the Russians, making it difficult for them to cooperate with the administration on all manner of international issues, not least being Syria, but also this unfolding catastrophe in Libya. And when President Obama, at least according to some, gave the impression that he was not in total control of his administration, when you saw Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland, who was married to the neoconservative Robert Kagan, begin to interfere in the internal affairs of Ukraine, leading to the stepping down of the previous leader, bringing to power not only the current leader, but causing Russia to then seize the Crimea, that led to this crisis with Russia, which has made it difficult for Mr. Obama to effectuate what he thought would be the centerpiece of his administration, which is the pivot towards China, confronting China. And, of course, as he said himself, that TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is all about confronting China. But he cannot really do that effectively, not least because he has to confront Russia and divert resources to Russia, which is why Secretary of State John Kerry, just a few days ago, went on his hands and knees begging an audience with President Putin in Sochi, and President Putin deigned to grant him an audience. And you can bet your bottom dollar that you're going to see Ukraine basically come to an end with regard to its 15 minutes of fame on the global stage there'll be an attempt to try to get some sort of bargain with regard to Ukraine so that there can be a turning towards China. But I think that that's probably too late. And as a result, I think that in terms of President Obama's job, the job that he gets paid $400,000 a year to execute, which is helping to promote the interests of U.S. imperialism, I think that objective historians will probably conclude that he has not done that job very well. But once again, it's not necessarily because of his personal foibles and personal defects. A lot of it has to do with the historical forces that were unleashed once he was elected as the first black president.
Well, let's just clean up this segment here with this question about the Saudi Arabia and other members of the Gulf Cooperation Council meeting with President Obama last week at Camp David. And there was a very palpable sense that they didn't actually leave with much except, with a lot of billions of dollars left on the table as orders for more military equipment. Did you get a sense that out of that meeting, the president in some way got a new kind of appreciation for what U.S. Foreign policy ought to be with respect to his allies in the Gulf? Is there a shift occurring there? Is he likely to make a shift, or was this just a wonderful opportunity for the U.S. to seal the deal on arms sales?
Well, raising the meeting with the Gulf Arab leadership at Camp David last week helps to illustrate the point that I was just seeking to make, which is that there are very powerful forces that have been unleashed that would make it difficult even for a President Utrecht Lee, with all of her capability, to execute the wishes that U.S. imperialism now demands. Mm. What I mean is that it's well known that many of the Gulf Arab leaders who President Obama was meeting with at Camp David are on board with regard to covert, if not overt, funding of the Islamic State, which the United States is seeking to combat on the Iraqi-Syria border. And it's also well known that by bombing Yemen, the Saudis in particular are helping to lead to the ascendancy in Yemen of al-Qaeda. And we have been told repeatedly that al-Qaeda is public enemy number one. And yet the United States is giving aid and comfort to Saudi Arabia as it helps to bring the ascendancy of al-Qaeda in Yemen. But it goes much deeper than that. Recall that in the past year, at least before, say, from June of 2014 up until late April of 2015, there had been a severe fall in the price of a barrel of oil. In recent weeks, it's recovered. But it fell from about $110 a barrel to $50 a barrel. And there was a lot of speculation as to why this was taking place, with many commentators suggesting that it was a U.S.-Saudi plan to wound Venezuela and to wound Russia, both of which are heavily dependent upon oil sales. And there might be something to that, but a more probing analysis might suggest that the Saudis were helping to drive down the price of oil in part to harm oil production in the United States, because the United States is on its way, if it's not already there, of being the leading oil producer in the world because of fracking and other technological means. It's now being debated by the Texas oil men, that is to say, they're putting pressure on Congress to allow for the more exporting of U.S. oil, which would cut in to Saudi revenues. In turn, the Saudis, like many countries now, have their finger to the wind. They know what time it is, so they're trying to send more oil to China. And in fact, that covert war that I just articulated with regard to Saudis versus Texas oil men is part of the undercurrent that it's leading President Obama to try to make this deal with the Iranians, which the Saudis and the Gulf areas, Arabs are very upset about. But in part, the oil question is pushing Mr. Obama in that direction, because if sanctions are lifted against Iran, that will allow even more oil to come onto the market, which the Saudis are not necessarily supportive of. At the same time, you see this de facto tacit objective alliance between the Saudis and the Israelis vis-a-vis Iran. And, of course, the Saudis and Israelis are very upset with President Obama because of this impending nuclear deal with Iran. We all know that the Republicans invited Prime Minister Netanyahu to Congress to denounce this deal just weeks ago. But at the same time, according to the Financial Times, in a very striking piece just a few days ago, the Israelis are developing very close financial relations with the Chinese themselves. I mean, they have their finger to the wind as well. Except that it's going to be very difficult for any U.S. administration to make any meaningful break with the Israelis, given the potency of the Israeli lobby within the Democratic Party and within the Republican Party, too, for that matter. Once again, at the end of the day, to repeat, even President Yutri's lead would have difficulty if faced with such a dilemma as President Obama is now facing.
Well, in the meantime, the United States is now the world's second largest economy. China has taken spot number one. Just last year, President Obama, speaking at the Nike factory in Oregon, talked about the fact that the United States has to, quote, write the rules for trade around the world. And if we don't, guess what? China will. And they'll write those rules in a way that gives Chinese workers and Chinese businesses the upper hand. Are we seeing manifest destiny here? Have we seen things come to pass? His prediction was on spot on?
Well, I'm glad you raised that point, because we're now marking the 40th anniversary of the ignominious U.S. evacuation from Vietnam in April 30th, 1975. And you may recall that part of the motive force for the ill-conceived U.S. intervention in Vietnam was the so-called domino theory. That is to say that there was this communist wave unfolding. That is to say the communists had come into power in Russia in 1917 and China in 1949 and North Vietnam during that same era. And that the United States had to confront the commies in Vietnam, otherwise they'd have to be confronted on the beaches of Southern California. But we also know that in the early 1970s, U.S. President Richard M. Nixon effectuated an entente with China that quickly led to bad blood, not only between China and Moscow, but also China and Vietnam. And so in 1979, in another turning point, after then-paramount Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping came to the United States for a 9-day visit, which included, of course, wearing that Texas hat when he visited Houston, which signaled that once he returned to China, he then tried to bloody the nose of Vietnam, which would be punishment for Vietnam ousting the United States. In other words, once Nixon went to China in the early 1970s, the rationale for the domino theory had basically evaporated. But rather than drawing that lesson and pulling out of Vietnam, the United States continued to wage that war and then rewarded China for waging war in Vietnam itself by pouring inward foreign direct investment into China at a gargantuan clip, which is now, as your prefatory comment suggested, has led to the conclusion by the Financial Times in 2014 and the International Monetary Fund as well that by certain measures, the Chinese economy has eclipsed the size of the U.S. economy, which is why, of course, President Obama talks incessantly about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And according to the Washington Post, uncharacteristically, he's been lobbying and twisting arms and log rolling members of Congress to get them to sign on to this. He hasn't been very successful with his own Democratic Party. If he gets so-called trade promotion authority, which would allow this partnership to go forward without amendments, he'll have to rely heavily upon the Republican Party. And Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, said just the other day that he felt President Obama's doing an excellent job on TPP, which is very unusual and very strange. In any case, this has engendered a full-throated denunciation from Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont and Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, which has led President Obama to criticize Senator Warren in particular. But it seems to me that the justifiable left-wing critique of the TPP is missing a very important point. Let me say, first of all, that I share in the critique of the TPP, but I'm unsettled and troubled by the left-wing argument that we should be against the TPP because it erodes U.S. sovereignty. I think that that argument should be deep-sixed, that should be scuttled. It has an odor of the old states' rights argument of the 1950s and 1960s that was used to oppose civil rights legislation, except in this place has been taken to the global level. As a black person, my history tells me that I have a much better chance of getting justice from an international body than a domestic body. I want to see U.S. sovereignty circumscribed. And I think that's part of the problem with the left-wing critique, because in many ways the left-wing critique mirrors the Tea Party critique, which also is opposed to the TPP because it circumscribes U.S. sovereignty. And I say this being aware of the fact that just a few days ago at the Human Rights Commission in Geneva, Switzerland, there was full-throated denunciation of police violence against black people in Baltimore, Ferguson, Cleveland, Staten Island, and all the rest. At the same time, as I've just articulated, you didn't see a change of laws with regard to deadly force by police officers in the state of Missouri in light of Ferguson. The prosecutor in Staten Island failed to get an indictment against a police officer who killed Eric Garner on tape. Instead, he got promoted. And yet, we see the international community circumscribing U.S. sovereignty by denouncing the United States. So this is part of the complication, it seems to me, that helps to link the domestic with the global. That is to say, our friends on the left too often times are taking simplistic arguments and not thinking things through. And I say this as well, as a supporter of Senator Bernie Sanders and his presidential effort, that there was a very striking article in the New York Amsterdam News, which, as you know, is the paper that serves the black community of greater New York, that criticized his policies on immigration, which is of great interest to a black community in New York that has Jamaican and Trinidadian and Barbadian roots. They feel that he has not been very progressive on the question of immigration. Likewise, Juliet Malveaux, the former president of the Historically Black Senate College, has criticized not only Senator Sanders, but also Senator Warren and Senator Sherrod Brown, all staunch opponents of TPP, for not speaking out more aggressively against police killings. Now, these are supposed to be our progressive leaders, and yet their constituents are being mowed down in the streets. Cleveland, in the case of Senator Sherrod Brown, yet they don't have a mumbling word to say. So how can we really credibly mount a progressive critique of President Obama or even Senator Hillary Clinton when supposedly our progressive stalwarts are as quiet as church mice when it comes to how some of us are being slain in the streets? Or are you still there? Hello?
I want to let's follow this line with China a bit, because China has launched, or is preparing to launch, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. And I wanted to get from you how this is being seen as against the IMF, and what is the significance of this bank?
Well, it's very significant. And in fact, it's a response to the fact that the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank are both headquartered in Washington, D.C., and as the New York Times editorial pointed out just a few days ago, have been reluctant to reform in order to reflect current realities. What I mean is, even though we, meaning black people, are told repeatedly that quotas are a bad thing, it goes against the principle of merit, and yet there's a quota with regard to the leadership of the World Bank, informally, if not rigidly. The leader of the World Bank has to be a U.S. national. The leader of the International Monetary Fund has to be a national of the Western Europeans or the European Union countries. And that's a quota. And yet, supposedly, that's a good thing. Now, these institutions came into existence in 1945 when there was a different world at play. And you can say the same thing about the United Nations Security Council, which still has Britain and France, these two pipsqueaks in Western Europe, having veto-wielding status and top-table status, along with the United States, China, and Russia, unfairly and unfortunately, and the United Nations Security Council also has not been reformed. So rather than take into account new realities where China's at the top table, where India is right behind, where the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa are surging, Congress, under Republican barbarian leadership, has basically turned a blind eye to reform. So China had no choice but to develop, along with the BRICS, these alternatives to the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. And so today, as we speak, we see Premier Li of China in Brazil, on his way to Peru and Colombia, talking about multi-billion dollar deals, including a railway that will run from the east coast of South America to the west coast of South America, allowing Brazilian resources to more easily get to China by taking that railway. We all know about, because we've talked about on this program, about how President Xi Jinping just last year was meeting with the Caribbean leaderships, and I was just reading in a Jamaican newspaper about all the money that's flooding into Jamaica from Chinese capital, including a road from Kingston to Montego Bay, including Chinese doctors coming to Jamaica to do free eye surgeries on Jamaicans who have eye problems, and all sorts of goodies that are being doled out by Beijing. And so what I'm suggesting to you is that we're living through a moment of transition. And this is a moment of transition no less portentous than the moment that came in the 20th century when Washington began to surpass London as being the leading capitalist country. And now we see the baton crossing the Pacific to Beijing. The difference, of course, is that both Washington and London, to a certain extent, came from the same stock, shall we say, racially and ethnically. But that's certainly not the case with regard to the baton passing from Washington to Beijing. And that's one of the reasons why, if you consult your bookstore, you'll find a flood of books coming out that are predicting ominously conflict between Washington and Beijing. We know that Secretary of State John Kerry, after crawling on his knees to Sochi to meet with President Putin in order to effectuate once again a reset with Russia, he then flew directly to China. And, of course, there is an ongoing confrontation of the South China Sea between U.S. vessels and Chinese vessels. The United States, ironically, is being backed to a certain degree by Vietnam, in reference to my previous discussion about the folly of the Vietnam War, which was based upon some supposed brotherhood that would last eternally between Vietnam and China. But the United States is also backed, to my dismay, by the Philippines as well. So this is leading to conflict and tension in a part of the world that could do with less of both of those forces. And that is one of the reasons why there are all these books coming out about a so-called impending war between China and the United States.
A very significant thing happened last week on the African continent, a meeting of the leaders of the East African community, at which we had Presidents Paul Kagame of Rwanda and Uhuru Kenyatta of Kenya proposing or insisting that Africa begin a very serious program of regional and continental integration. What do you think of this idea? It got no coverage. I hadn't seen the story anywhere here in the United States, but it seems to me to have been a very significant development.
Oh, it's very significant, and obviously it taps into ideas put forward decades ago by Prime Minister Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana, and the whole idea of the United States of Africa. And then, of course, the African Union, which replaced the Organization of African Unity just a few years ago, has had as a mandate ever since day one of more cohesive economic and financial integration of African nations, you see that to a degree in terms of the blocks. What I mean is the Southern African Development Community, which is seeking to integrate the economies of Southern Africa, that is to say Zimbabwe, South Africa, Namibia, Angola, all the rest. You see that kind of block developing in East Africa as well. And what's interesting is that we know that one of the important trends in terms of the political economy of Africa that's unfolding as we speak is that as labor unrest and wages rise in China, you see more factories moving from China to East Africa in particular, particularly to Ethiopia, which has a huge population of about 90 million. But we also see that just as we've discussed a Pacific Rim, and we've discussed how countries that border the Pacific Ocean from the United States and Mexico and Peru on the east bank of the Pacific to China on the west bank of the Pacific are developing certain kinds of economic coordination, given the fact that vessels can sail directly from the east coast to the west coast without impediment. With the development of the Indian economy, we see that there are now analysts who are speaking of an Indian Ocean Rim or an Indian Rim, just like we've had discussion of a Pacific Rim. And given the fact that India is the belle of the ball, what I mean is all the major powers are seeking to court India right now. You might have noticed that Prime Minister Modi was in Beijing just a few days ago. Mm-hmm. And billions of dollars in deals were effectuated despite the fact that tensions exist between India and China. China, of course, is worried that India will ally with its longtime friend, Japan. Their relationship goes back 2,500 years to the founding of Buddhism. They'll ally to the detriment of China. We all know that President Obama has been to India and has been courting India to try to get it into some sort of anti-Beijing alliance. And so all of this capital is flooding into India, and part of that capital is now helping to develop this whole Indian Ocean basin. And, of course, if you look at your map, you'll see that Kenya, of course, is the key nation in terms of the Indian Ocean basin, that despite the problems with neighboring Somalia, including al-Shabaab massacring Kenyan residents repeatedly in recent months and in recent years, the Nairobi and the Kenyan economy are developing. You see that in terms of Rwanda, despite the fact that it has many problems, not least the aftermath of the genocide of 1994, and not least being the President Paul Kagame is trying to finagle with the Constitution to get a third term, that one of the things that is happening in Rwanda is development of telecommunications, which will allow for an economic great leap forward. Now, to be sure, there are significant problems in that part of Africa, and that's a euphemism. I'm sure you've been following the situation in Burundi, which has an ethnic makeup similar to Rwanda, that is to say Tutsis and Hutus, and how President Nkurunziza had also been trying to finagle with the Constitution. He would say not, but that's the charge of his opponents, to get a third term, and how that led to an attempted coup just a few days ago, and how that led to unrest in the streets, and it's still leading to unrest in the streets. And we also know that Burundi, pursuant to an African Union mandate, has been sending troops to fight al-Shabaab in Somalia, as has Uganda and Kenya. Well, that's one of the reasons why Somalia has been retaliating against Kenya. Now there's a fear that Somalia, or at least al-Shabaab, I should say, will be retaliating against Burundi. So those are major league problems. But at the same time, we would be remiss if we focused unduly and in a one-sided manner on those problems and ignored the thrust of your question, which is that the economic integration of Africa is proceeding apace, and there are positive prospects based upon larger global trends, not least being the development of the Indian Ocean basin.
But when you say things like regional and continental integration, when a head of state uses these kinds of words, they tend to be interpreted really as a sign of resistance, especially by colonial powers, that these two presidents in particular are signaling a new level of relationship with the former colonial powers, and that always, almost always, means some kind of war. Africa is very valuable. Even those countries that have achieved, quote, independence, unquote, the European powers are not about to let their former colonies go. So when we see this movement taking root, aren't we also supposed to expect a great resistance by former colonial powers?
Well, absolutely. And I think the capital to watch here is Paris. I mean, you know, there's been a strange relationship in particular between black Americans and Paris. Because France was trying to steal a march on the United States, it often embraced warmly black Americans like Josephine Baker, you might recall, who was had roots in St. Louis, Missouri, and then moved to Paris in the 1920s and became a celebrated performer and participated in the French Resistance and was warmly embraced by the French. You know, James Baldwin, Richard Wright, musicians too numerous to mention, all embraced by Paris. At the same time, those who had direct roots in Senegal and in Congo-Brazzaville and in Madagascar were not necessarily embraced by France, which is to put it mildly. And so we know that France's pretensions to be a major power basically rest upon its exploitation of a good deal of Africa, particularly controlling the economies of a good deal of Africa, where the currency itself in many so-called Francophone African nations are basically based upon calculations made in Paris. That's why it was so stunning to see just a few days ago on France 24, which is the French-based TV network, that Côte d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast, which is in that category of being a kind of neo-colony of France, and is also a major producer of cocoa, for the first time is developing a plant to produce chocolate from the cocoa that it produces, rather than sending the cocoa abroad, where it is then produced and then sold in elite shops in Manhattan and elsewhere. Now, to be sure, the plant in Côte d'Ivoire is not necessarily controlled by nationals of Côte d'Ivoire, but in any case, that is a kind of step towards economic independence of a sort that France routinely frowns upon. And we also know that France historically has been interfering in the internal affairs of countries like Côte d'Ivoire, basically dislodging the previous president and installing the current president, not only dislodging the previous president, but arresting his wife and sending her, trying to send her to the International Criminal Court to be charged. And this is very typical of France. I mean, we see its interference in the internal affairs of Mali. We see that it has had bad relations with Algeria ever since Algerian independence over 50 years ago because of an abject refusal to accept Algerian sovereignty. I mentioned Madagascar. It's one of the more curious aspects of global history is the fact that France, after being bludgeoned and battered by Germany during World War II, somehow gathered the wherewithal to try to reclaim its colony in Madagascar, and in 1946-1947 massacred in one of the neglected but sordid tales of world history, massacred tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of Africans who were surging towards what they considered to be independence. So yes, you are correct to suggest that when there is talk about economic integration of Africa, that the traditional powers, France not least, object strenuously. But what we need to realize is that the balance of forces globally is shifting. With the rise of China and the rise of the BRICS, the French should be more concerned about the Chinese incursions into the French economy, into the Western European economies, than concern about Africans trying to claim economic integration and independence, because, as you probably know, I mean, there's been a flood, a veritable tidal wave of Chinese capital, not only into France, but in Western Europe in general, which is raising searching questions, quite frankly, about the sovereignty of those European nations.
Well, it's 5 months since the great romance began between the United States and Cuba. How do you read the relationship so far?
Well, it seems to be going along. Once again, you have to realize there are grand historical forces that are pushing Havana and Washington together. I've mentioned Russia. We all know that even with Kerry's trip to Sochi to meet with President Putin, relations with Russia are not the best. There have been these credible news stories about Russian planes flying off the coast of Alaska, flying off the coast of California, flying off the coast of the Gulf of Mexico. We all recall the Cuban Missile Crisis, so-called, of October 1962, when Cuba, in its revolutionary infancy, was a kind of base that was being used, shall we say, by Moscow to target Washington, leading to a nuclear standoff between the three powers, Cuba, the United States, and the Soviet Union. We all know about the flood of capital, once again from China, that's not only coming into Cuba, but as noted, into the Caribbean nations, and including Bahamas, right off the southern tip of Florida. And so the United States felt that the better part of wisdom was to try to get on the right side of Havana. And interestingly enough, because the press does not like to portray the United States as being a supplicant, as being susceptible to world historical forces, you haven't seen that kind of story, generally speaking, in the mainstream press. Instead, you've heard stories about how the Cuban economy on its last legs, and Raul Castro is crawling to Washington to try to get good relations, and President Obama basically tries to throw him a lifeline. I mean, those are fairy tales for children. Now, to be sure, the Cuban economy has suffered because of the blockade, and Cuba does want positive relations with Washington. And as a result, I think that positive relations will ensue. I just noticed that the President Castro just mentioned that he expects ambassadors to be appointed sooner rather than later. The scuttlebutt in Washington is that leading member of the Congressional Black Caucus, Barbara Lee of Berkeley, Oakland, may be appointed the ambassador to Cuba. And quite frankly, I can't think of a better choice. I mean, it would be mind-blowing if that were to occur. And so things are moving along. And of course, you also see how the Cuban biotech industry, which has really rather advanced, believe it or not, has been cooperating with Big Pharma in terms of lung cancer. In particular, those who are suffering from lung cancer might get a respite because of the improvement of relations. Tourists are flooding into Havana. I mean, the reports I receive is that it's almost impossible to get a hotel room now. So relations and then you saw that President Castro met with the Pope just recently in the Vatican and was suitably impressed with the Argentinian Pope to the point where he said that he wasn't joking about perhaps returning to his Jesuit roots and rejoining the Catholic Church. And then, of course, Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, the presidential contender, then cracked. Well, if he does, he'll have a long confession to engage in with his parish priest. But all joking aside, things seem to be motoring along quite nicely between Havana and Washington.
Well, that brings us to the end of our program today. It was a grand tour, as usual. Thank you so much, Gerald, for putting before us all these different component parts that we will not get anyplace else but from you, the way you are able to link the domestic with the international and also from an entirely different class perspective and a political perspective. So I want to thank you again for your insights and your contribution to our knowledge today. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks a lot. Well, that brings us to the end of the program. I hope there was a lot there. I must tell you, and you must know, there was a lot there to chew on. And this is why when we discuss these matters, we just let That I liken Gerald Horn to a self-guided missile. He knows exactly where we ought to go, and that is why I so cherish our moments with him, because it is instruction of a very different order at a very high level. So I want to thank him for that, and thank you for listening. Stay tuned. Coming up next is The Infectious Myth with David Crowe. And, of course, you can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. That's my email. Or on Facebook. I'm trying to get, current with the Facebook page. I'm also trying to keep up with all of your wonderful, wonderful encouraging messages and your good thoughts and prayers. I'm so grateful. And that is why I say always, it is a great pleasure and a great, great privilege to be in your company. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.